Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon, referred to by Mr. Bush Sr. as Little Beirut. And today we debut live in Portland as well, thanks to AM 620 KPOJ, now our flagship station. And so glad to be here. Interesting piece of legislation. By the way, there's a lot in the news that we are going to be getting to. Today is the fourth anniversary, or this broadly, this several-day period, the fourth anniversary of the taking down of Saddam's statue and the very carefully staged event where a bunch of Ahmed Chalabi's good and well-paid buddies stood around and produced a marvelous photo op for the American corporate media 4 years ago. And Muqtada al-Sadr, the guy whose men killed Cindy Sheehan's son, has something to say about that. He's out saying, throw out the occupiers, us. And so we will get into that. In fact, I want to spend much of the second hour of our program on that. And in our third hour, we're going to be talking about voting fraud versus election fraud and the big lie and the little lie and Paul Krugman's piece and just the entire strategy of the Republican Party these days. Right now, however, I want to get into this issue of hate crime legislation. Andrew Anthos was a 72-year-old gay man, was not a gay activist, but he was not he was open about being gay. His main passion in life was a 20-year campaign. He literally worked on this thing for 20 years to illuminate the state capitol in Michigan in red, white, and blue at least one night a year as a statement of patriotism, the 72-year-old guy. And according to police and family members, this from the South Bend Tribune, he was riding a city bus home from a library on February 13th, singing along in a quiet tenor voice to Spanish music in his headphones. A young man came up to him and asked him if he was a, quote, faggot, end quote. Anthos ignored him. The man followed Anthos off the bus, confronted him again. Anthos reportedly told the man he was gay as he was helping a wheelchair-using friend who was stuck in a snowbank. The man struck Anthos in the back of the head with a pipe and stood over him as Lee lay on the ground, then ran off after his friend started yelling for help. Anthos fell into a coma February 21st and 2 days later died. This is the event that has inspired Congressman John Conyers, along with eight Republicans and 131 Democrats, to introduce legislation that would include hate crimes prevention legislation to include gender and sexual orientation and you know, basically that whole realm of stuff as hate crimes. And we have with us Republican presidential candidate and author of Politics, Inc., Principle Not Profit, Why We Need Statesmen Not Career Politicians, and Campaign for Prosperity and Renewal, John Cox. His website, cox2008.com, and theonlyrealconservative.org is two websites on this topic. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you. Hope you had a great Easter.
Thank you, and I hope I did, and I hope you did too. You are suggesting in the news release that we got from you that passage of hate crimes legislation that will protect gays, lesbians, transgendered folks, bisexuals, that passage of legislation like this is going to cause a sudden explosion of cross-dressing. I'm confused.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case, but you know, let's face it, Tom. I'd like to see that guy put in jail, the guy that attacked that man, put in jail for the rest of his life, and he ought to be. The trouble with hate crime legislation is that it's being pushed by people who have a different agenda. They want to punish thought. They want to make it a crime to criticize anybody for any kind of behavior. And, you know, we have to have judgment in this world, and we have to be able to say that certain behavior is good and certain behavior is bad. We have to be able to teach our children that kind of stuff. What we don't need to get is government involved in punishing thought. A guy who attacks somebody because they believe they're gay should go to jail because they're attacking somebody, and they should be going to jail for a long, long time.
Okay, so let me, I just want to understand this. We're talking with Republican John Cox, Republican candidate for president. You said that the guy who killed Mr. Anthos, who hit him in the back of the head with a pipe
should
go to prison for the rest of his life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now,
I don't believe
what
in the death
if...
penalty, so I don't want to see him executed, but I think he ought to be in a locked cell with 4x8 or 4x3 or whatever it is and not see the light of day ever again.
Right. And so you want this guy to be nailed.
Yeah.
Now, what if, I don't know the guy's name, who is the perpetrator in the crime. Let's say his name is Joe Blow. What if Joe had been walking, what if he was a construction worker and he was walking down the street with a 6-foot piece of pipe over his shoulder and he turned to look at a squirrel in the back and the pipe hit Mr. Anthos in the back of the head and killed him exactly the same way he died. Would you then want that guy to go to jail for the rest of his life?
No, I mean, that sounds like an accident.
Okay. The difference is, that if he was walking down the street with a piece of pipe over his shoulder, he was thinking about going to work, whereas if he walks up to Mr. Anthos and strikes him on the back of the head, he's thinking about killing the guy, right?
Oh, I see what you're going to get to here, Tom. You're going to get to the fact that if that guy a couple days before had said he didn't like gay people, that now you're going to ascribe ill motive to that, and you're going to make it sound like there was proof that he intentionally did it. And you know,
what I'm saying, John, is that we already put people in prison for thinking. In fact, it is the basis of our criminal justice system. What was the intent of the perpetrator? If somebody walks, you know, if somebody picks up my wallet and walks off with it because they think it's theirs, then the penalty for that is very different than if they pick up my wallet and walk off with it because they know it's mine.
Well, that's a question of proof, and that's a question of somebody's intent and their guilt.
And intent is one of the major focal points of actions at law.
But it's not punishing that thought, though, Tom. I mean, I think it's a
yes, it is.
Different. And the issue here about cross-dressing, and the reason that's put in there, and obviously that's done sensationally in order to get you to want me on the show by our booking.
Well, then defend it.
PR people. But here's the point. I mean, you don't want to have people being put in jail for having thoughts or even having opinions. I mean, the First Amendment is about being able to have an opinion if you want to.
I have read House Resolution 1000. I have a copy of it sitting right here in front of me. Nowhere in this bill, John Conyers legislation, nowhere in this bill does it say that anybody can go to jail for thinking.
No, of course not, but it's the progression.
So why are you saying that?
The slippery slope of saying you're going to make the crime increased if someone had a thought or if someone had a judgment.
This is the slippery slope that we started in 1798 when we became a nation and we said that there are different degrees of, and the various states said that there are different degrees of murder, that there's unintentional murder, manslaughter, that there is murder at the spur of the moment, which would be second degree murder, and there's murder with malice aforethought, first degree murder. Yeah. And all three of those grades of murder have to do with what you're thinking. Now, you know, if you want to call this a slippery slope, I'll say, okay, we've been on that slippery slope for, you know, 1,000 years of civilization, but this is merely an appropriate extension of that.
Listen, I'm a lawyer. Those laws are designed to be based upon what you're doing in the context. In other words, if you're robbing...
In the context of what you're thinking.
It's not your thought. It's what you're doing. It's not necessarily...
It's your behavior motivated by your thought, and that's what John Conyers' law says, as you just agreed. Nowhere in this law does it say you can be prosecuted for thinking. You can be prosecuted for intent.
Aggravated assault is based upon what you're doing at the time, Tom. If you're robbing somebody or if you're doing some other, committing another felony, then you're able to get a bigger penalty.
No, assault is based on what you're doing. Aggravated assault is based on what you're thinking.
Not necessarily, no. It's about action.
In the vast majority of cases, John, you have to acknowledge this. The difference between assault and aggravated assault has to do with intent.
Not necessarily, no, actually. I mean, I had one criminal law course. I'm a CPA. I'm a business lawyer, okay? I'm not a criminal lawyer.
The difference, let's take one that everybody knows. The difference between manslaughter and first-degree murder is that first-degree murder, you have to demonstrate intent. We already have what you're calling thought crimes on the books. In fact, the vast majority of all of our crimes.
No, first-degree murder is all about whether it was contemplated ahead of time.
That's my point, whether you intended to murder somebody.
Well, but that's not your free thoughts about whether you like a certain activity or whether you don't like a certain activity. I think, again, it's this slippery slope, Tom. If you get in the position where you're going to start putting people or aggravating crime or doing other things and punishing the ideas that people have in their own mind, even if they don't even have...
You're not punishing the idea. You're punishing the behavior because it's motivated by that idea.
Wow.
The guy who killed his wife out in California, you know, who was pregnant with a kid and it was all the news for a whole year and a half, I mean, it was because he intended, because he thought about it, he planned it.
The ridiculous extent extension of this, Tom, is that we get laws like the one out in California where the little girl is prosecuted for calling some kid gay on the playground. I mean,
that is not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is people committing hate crimes, violent crimes against other people.
What we're talking about here are people trying to cater to a certain interest group, gays, who don't like to be insulted. I wouldn't blame them.
Who
like
don't want
to
be assaulted
either.
Okay, John Cox. John, we have to wrap it up. Cox2008.com. I appreciate your coming on. TheOnlyRealConservative.org as well. Thanks, John. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
The hour on the radio support group of By and For We the People of the United States of America and all other life forms on Earth. Tom Hartman here with you. This, we are witnessing the emergence in all probability of the next right wing, set it up for the election, culture war talking point, see it on Fox, get it all, you know. John Conyers has introduced a piece of legislation. That was John Conyers, the congressman from Michigan. I believe he represents the district where this Andrew Anthos, the man who was murdered, this 72-year-old gay man who was beaten to death with a pipe as he was trying to help a friend who was a wheelchair-bound friend who was stuck in a snowbank. I believe that Mr. Anthos lived in John Conyers' district, and John Conyers has introduced this piece of legislation. In fact, I'm not even sure that they caught the guy who did it, because I'm looking through this news story here, and there's no evidence of the perpetrator's name, suggesting that hate crimes, which now include, you know, a variety of things, including gender and race, should be expanded to include sexual orientation. And the right, the conservatives are just are all upset about it. This from you know, one of their news releases: members of pro-family groups are beside themselves over the possibility of this freakish sideshow legislation actually becoming law. Under the auspices of fighting hate crimes, the measure could be interpreted as having the power to imprison people who simply couldn't recognize the intended gender portrayal of another person, causing them to respond in an unlawful way. Come on. If the unlawful way is beating the bejesus out of somebody or killing them, well, yeah. And particularly if they're doing it because of the person's sexual orientation or because of the way that they're dressed or because of how they, I mean, it's just, that may reflect their sexual orientation. I mean, what, the largest frame here, when you get right down to it and you look at this in the largest lens, we have always had hate crime laws in the United States. They are, and around the world, they are at the core of civilization. They are at the core of the entire idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That if somebody is hatefully committing crimes, we are going to, if they are doing it in a way that is methodical, that is intentional, if they're doing, whether it's Charlie Manson or John Wayne Gacy or whatever, if they are doing it with intent, and obviously repeatedly, the examples I gave were serial killers, but I mean there's certainly a lot of one-offs, you know, where somebody just blows a cork and off they go, or where they plan it. We have from the very beginning, I mean, I would submit to you, going back probably 7,000 years to ancient Sumerian law, we have always from the very beginning said, if a crime is motivated by hate, then that crime is a more heinous crime than a crime that is committed by accident or on the spur of the moment. We have always said that. Intent has always been part of our legal system, and it has always been part of the way that we prosecute and sentence people. The type of sentence that people get is a variation on this. The conservative talking points. If the Conyers measure passes, an unprecedented circus could ensue with police officers called to a, quote, crime scene, end quote, getting so confused that they might not know who or what to arrest. Say what? And then they go on to say, sexual orientation, gender identity. We know what gender is, male and female. But gender identity includes transsexuals, cross-dressers, and a whole myriad of personas who are sometimes, quite frankly, difficult for anyone to distinguish which gender they most closely resemble. Okay, and if that's the case, it's a rather demeaning characterization, but even then, if that's the case, and somebody decides to set out and bash somebody upside the head because of it, that's a crime. But the right-wingers go, but be careful not to mumble too loud, or some poor policeman will have to execute a federal mandate to pick you up and arrest you for daring to insult some entity he has to describe in his police report of a person who is simply indescribable. I'm sorry, we are not talking about arresting people for what they think. John Conyers' legislation in no place says that a person can be arrested for thinking, or by and large for speaking. If a crime is committed and there is a specific intent to harm somebody because they are African American, because they are gay, because they are female or male, whatever the case may be. There's a variety of these things that are included in hate crime legislation, and this is simply a logical extension of that. This is part of the process of bringing gay Americans into the family of Americans and saying, you're part of all of us, and we acknowledge that you represent a minority that has historically been persecuted and inappropriately prosecuted. And as such, as part of trying to clean up our act and remediate this long history of ills, we are going to include this, you as a category in the hate crimes legislation that's also trying to remediate a long history of ills against other minorities. Just seems appropriate to me. Your thoughts after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Our toll-free number, 1-866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. I hang out there during the breaks and say hi. And also AirAmerica.com for our blog. And there's a message board also, TomHartman.com. All of them linking to each other in various ways and places. Robert in San Francisco on the Robert, you're on the air. What's up?
Tom, you're exactly right in this. There are classifications of crimes that involve things like homicide. That if you kill somebody while you're engaged in theft, or if you attack a child and kill the child, some sexual assault or some enhanced punishments are available. Now, if you think of strange fruit, they used to go and hang and string up blacks in the South. A lot of times, because they were successful and had property, and they wanted to buy at auction their property for cents in the dollar. You don't think that the people, the white racists that killed those blacks, would go and kill a white? Because there's different treatment given when you kill a white. When you kill a white, you get just recompense. But when you kill a black, well, they're only three-fifths human. So, that whole codification thing really shows the racist bent, whatever you want to call it. But people that have been victimized need to be a protected class, and it affects the whole group. If you attack somebody because they're of a certain persuasion, that sends a chilling message to everyone. Society has not just the responsibility, but the duty.
And this is my point, and let me even take it to the next step, Robert, and that is, why do we have these laws in the first place? We don't have these laws principally to be able to arrest and prosecute people. That's the side effect of the laws. We have the laws on the books principally to prevent people from engaging in the behavior in the first place. And go ahead.
To establish liberty and justice for all. I mean, and this is what I believe a lot of people are waking up to. We need constitutional government, not de facto government. We need everybody from whether they're the richest people in the country to the poorest. We need the same treatment across the board, and people that wear the black robes need to wake up to this and start enforcing it in that way.
Okay. Well said. Robert, thank you very much for the call. Nick in Detroit. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes. I was basically going to make a similar point to the last caller there. It's that the hate crimes aren't necessarily about killing or injuring the victim of the crime. It's more about intimidation towards that person.
The entire class of people.
Right, exactly.
Right. Good point and well said, Nick. Thank you very much for amplifying that. Eric in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Eric.
Hi, how's it going, Tom? I just wanted to say that, in general, I find these kinds of crimes disgusting, and if you're going to have hate crimes legislation, you absolutely must include homosexuals, because it is the same sort of thing as African-American or any other group that may be victimized by hate group.
Traditional oppressed minorities, I guess, would be a broad category.
Exactly. I do think, however, it's important to clarify the opposing argument, not necessarily to say that I agree with it, but I think what Mr. Cox is trying to say is that there is a distinction between acknowledging, yes, there was an intent with forethought and malice to kill, and then saying, okay, well, now let's judge it based upon what the specific reason was. Like, for instance, if I kill someone, with forethought because I hate them versus killing them with forethought because I want their money, I mean, those are both first-degree murder.
We do that all the time. I mean, frankly, in many cases, in ways that I would deplore. For example, people who commit crimes against members of their family are less likely to get as severe a sentence as people who commit crimes against total strangers.
That's right, and that was going to be my next point, is that usually these things tend to come out in the sentencing, that, they take these sorts of reasons into account. So, me personally, I don't have a problem with just, promoting these things up to the initial law itself, rather than having to leave it up to the judge, where you're basically leaving up to the possibly the prejudices of the judge himself or the jury, whoever it is that makes these decisions.
Well, the judge and juries, these are not at least my read of this bill, and I'm not an attorney, so maybe I read it wrong, but my read of this bill is that it's not creating mandatory sentences. It is increasing the high end, the top end of the latitude that a judge and jury would have in sentencing. That you can add, if at the discretion of the prosecutor, they can demonstrate that there was, in addition to the crime, there was an intent to try to intimidate that class of people as well as that individual, then they can, amp up the sentence, as it were, by saying this is also a hate crime. And I think that that's, just a reasonable, appropriate thing. Eric, thank you for your call. Well said. Justin in Manhattan. Hey, Justin.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
The last couple callers there kind of took the wind out of my sails, especially the last one. But I did want to say that I thought you were kind of interchanging motive with intent, as far as, if you intended to kill the man when you raised the pipe over your head, that's intent. And whether it was because he was gay or his shoes are untied, that's motive. And
You're right. And the reason that I was conflating the two is because on the other side, they are conflating the two. They're saying that that a policeman will have to arrest people because of what they're thinking. I mean, that's the literally the statement that they made in their news release. And, I don't think it's true.
That's ridiculous. Murder with the intent to kill someone, that's murder. And I'm not really sure. I'm definitely sure I agree with you that people do these things to intimidate gays and blacks and other minorities, and that's wrong. And I'm not sure if we can legislate that, or if you can legislate motive. It's not the same thing as intent. I don't know. It's definitely a society.
Well, we certainly have. I mean, we've had hate crimes on the books for quite some time. It's, you know.
With that being true, we have to include gays to bring them into the family.
I agree. The only alternative would be to do away with the hate crimes legislation.
I could get behind either one of those ideas.
Yeah.
But we're not going to exclude gays from the idea. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, well said, Justin. Thank you very much. Mary in San Diego, California. Hey, Mary.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I am actually a practicing criminal defense attorney here in San Diego. And,
oh, great.
We have.
You know more about this than I do, so.
Yeah, actually, we have had hate crime legislation on our books for quite a number of years. I don't know exactly how many. But essentially, the way it works is, a person's charged with a criminal act, like, say, assault. And then, so the assault has to be proven, has to be proved that there was a criminal act and a joint union of act and intent, so criminal intent plus the act.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you add what's called an allegation that the crime was motivated by hate.
Mm-hmm.
And they're listed in the statute.
The categories of hate, as it were, or the categories of the protected classes against which hate is used to intimidate an entire
yes.
class of people.
So basically the statute says hate crime means a criminal act committed in whole or in part because one or more of the following or actual or perceived characteristics of the victim, disability, gender, nationality, race or ethnicity, religion, or sexual orientation.
Right.
And then it goes on to say that gender means sex and includes a person's gender identity and gender-related appearance and behavior, whether or not stereotypically associated with the person's assigned sex at birth.
So this is a California law, not
the federal.
This
is a California law.
Right. So basically Conyers is proposing a federal law that would be identical to the California law.
Exactly. And the way it works is, you know, generally motive is not something that a prosecutor would have to prove in a crime, whereas with enhancements like this, in order to prove the enhancement, you do have to prove that the criminal behavior was motivated by some kind of hatred against the protected class of people.
Right.
So,
and Mary, am I correct in my assumption that the reason for this kind of legislation is because the assumption at law is that at some level, when people are committing hate crimes against protected classes, that they are attempting not just to inflict damage on that individual, but to intimidate the entire class of people.
Exactly right, and to discourage others from following that lead, because what...
That's why we have the law.
Yeah, and the way that right. it's structured here in California is it adds a substantial period of criminal penalty sanction in addition to what would normally be the upper term
right.
sanction for the crime.
Right, which brings us to the point that the reason why we have laws on the books at the most primary level, at the most, you know, original, visceral level, is not so much to punish as to prevent.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, to set an example against people who break these laws. But
right.
but primarily, you know, as Martin Luther King said, you know, if we can get people to act differently, then hopefully the minds will follow. And
very,
I think that
very well said.
Particularly in the state of California, where, you know, we're not quite so, I hope to think, not quite so uptight and judgmental, about people who have lifestyles that might be different than ours, but
visited Orange County recently, Mary.
I'm sorry?
I said you haven't visited Orange County recently. I think
well,
Dana
yeah,
Rohrabacher, the people who vote for him.
I talking you know. About Orange County. They would definitely be excluded. But I think in particularly in the San Francisco area, San Diego is pretty open-minded, although still
yeah.
a pretty conservative
yeah.
place.
And I really shouldn't pick on Orange County. There's actually a lot of good Democrats and a lot of good progressives in Orange County as well. It continually amazes me some of the Republicans that get sent to Washington D.C. from California. You know, Pombo and Rohrabacher and some of these guys. They just boggle my mind. Jerry Lewis. Mary, thanks for the call. I really appreciate the info and the insight. And we will continue with your calls and thoughts on this topic. In just a moment, 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
You're listening- listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Guitar, a little bit of truck, a little bit of hound dog, and a little bit of luck, a little bit of bacon, a little bit of beans, a little bit of you loving up on me, a little bit of how it's supposed to be, a little bit of life, a little bit of backseat.
Truth and common sense in broadcasting. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Truth teller, how you doing, man?
Just great. You live in South Park, Colorado. I've seen that place on television.
No, it's a for real place, and you see the show?
I do with some regularity, yeah.
That's kind of where it's at.
I confess.
I was wondering if this applied in any way to starting a war where you only have poor people dying and not your good friends.
Yeah, in other words, can we extend hate crime legislations to things like, lying your way into a war?
Yeah, exactly. I think that would
Did Bush hate Saddam Hussein? Is that why he attacked him?
He
did try to kill my daddy, you know.
He cut in the money. That's why.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's an interesting idea. Well, it's a very interesting idea. Thanks a lot for the call. Leanne in Indiana. Hey, Leanne.
Hello. I thank you so much for being in existence, especially in the state of Indiana.
Well, thank you for listening. What's up?
You know, what really just baffles me, as a gay woman, I can't make myself care about anybody else's sexuality. I just can't. I mean, I try to, like, be the good gossiper and, you know, who's dating who or who wants to get with whoever. I can't even make myself care, which gets to the root of this whole issue to me is why... Why do people care so much that they can even hate you?
Yeah, let me take a shot at answering that. I actually think that there's an answer to that question. I think that there is a fundamental difference between the conservative worldview and the liberal worldview. The classic conservative worldview, I'm talking, you know, hundreds of years, including modern conservatives, and the classic liberal worldview, which goes back to the 1600s, the modern version of it. And that is that the classic conservative worldview defines morality as what people do in secret. In other words, who's sleeping with whom, who's smoking what, that kind of thing. And and the classic liberal worldview defines morality as what we do as a society. The conservative worldview is all about the individual. The liberal worldview is more all about the community. So the classic liberal definition of morality would be, are there hungry among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there sick among us? If so, then we cannot call ourselves moral. Whereas the conservative worldview would say, are there people among us who are doing things that we think is wrong? If so, then we cannot call ourselves as a society moral. And I think that there's, you know, at some core fundamental level, there is some truth to both points of view. I personally, and I suspect you as well, hold to the liberal worldview as the primary locus of morality. What are we all about here together as a community? But conservatives are very worried about what individuals are doing in the privacy of their own bedrooms, and therefore they try to turn it into law. Make sense?
That absolutely makes sense. That's the best argument I think I've heard. I think Indiana could use a little higher education. That might actually help, you know, form.
Well, that's one of the things. That's why colleges turn people into liberals, because they A, inform them, and B, teach them critical thinking skills. Leanne, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Well, just a couple points on this. One, it makes no logical sense, obviously, not to include sexual orientation in hate crimes law. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And
not to include them, right?
Yeah, I mean, just logically, it just, you know, to leave them out. I just don't understand it. So, but the part of this that bothers me, I had another point, but I forgot it. But the main point is this: what bothers me about this is that. Take the two hypothetical cases, you know, this guy who attacked that poor old man with a pipe because he hated gays. So that, you know, he obviously committed that crime with intent, you know, malice aforethought or whatever they call it. And, you know,
criminal malice.
Should be locked up for life. Then you take an identical case of a guy who attacks the same old man and say he does it for the person's wallet, or he says he does it for fun. Are we good? Is he not going, you know, is there, you know, are we going to treat him lighter? Is it not a hate crime? Is it?
Yes, because there's a difference. Because the guy who attacks the guy because he's gay is not just attacking that one man. He's attacking an entire class of people. He's essentially, as we look at it at a societal level, he's making a statement to all of society that gays better look out. This is not unlike the statement that Hitler made on Kristallnacht against the Jews in Germany. Look out, an entire class of people, watch out.
I understand the logic, but what does this mean? The person who attacks the person for fun, I mean, he's getting a lighter sentence because the enhancement is not there, so we're... In a sense, saying it's less bad to attack somebody for fun than it is to attack somebody because you're motivated.
That's right, because it's not two crimes. It's not two crimes. It's only one crime. If you're attacking somebody for fun, that's the one crime of attacking somebody for fun. If you're also trying to intimidate an entire class of people at the same time, if you're attacking people as they're walking out of a synagogue or out of a Catholic church because they're Jewish or Catholic, then you're trying to send a message to Jews or Catholics as well as attacking those individuals that you're attacking. That's, well, you know, it's like the guy who was, you know, Eric Rudolph, who blew up the gay bar in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta at the time that happened. You know, he was trying to send a message to an entire class of people. That is a more heinous crime than trying to harm one individual in my mind. And that's, you know, we can discuss it. But Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael in Seattle. Michael, we just have a few seconds before we have to wrap up this first hour of the program.
Hey, good morning. Basically, I think that the whole mentality behind this is really sheds light on the conservative mentality in general, and it's just they have their minds completely shut, and they are unable to accept another viewpoint, and when they are confronted with facts, they just obfuscate it and argue it with opinion, and it's really quite frustrating.
Yeah, I'd say it goes beyond just, you know, facts and not facts. It has to do with that fundamental notion of what's right and what's wrong, and how you define morality, and how you define, you know, what's acceptable behavior in society, and where, at what levels you enforce that. And frankly, most of us are concerned about making sure that acceptable behavior in society doesn't include not only trying to hurt individuals, but also to intimidate entire classes of people. And conservatives, frankly, don't care if big classes are intimidated. 57 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
It's the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't believe so. Not a chance. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Today is the fourth anniversary of the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein, that marvelous photo opportunity, and marvelous at least from the point of view of the Bush administration. And I think it's useful for us to consider some of the things that have happened since then, and also what led us up to it. First of all, I just want to give great kudos to Jane Harman for speaking out on this and speaking with integrity and honesty, just the congresswoman from California. Her statement, she was speaking at the Center for American Progress about Iraq, and well, here's her comment.
I don't think that the surge will succeed because I think our combat mission cannot succeed. And putting more good lives after good lives, as I've put it, doesn't make any sense to me.
This is, you know, the core idea that the solution to the situation in Iraq is political. We created, using military force, a political crisis. And then we failed to even address it over the next 4 years, and not just a political crisis. Arguably, you could say, you know, politics has to do with the life of people, the quality of life of people. It's one of the tools that we use to help define and improve the quality of life of people, or at least progressives and liberals think that that's one of the goals of it, and of politics. And history demonstrates that's so. That's the foundation of this country. And Jane Harman pointing out, sorry, you can blow up. You know, you can kill more people and you can blow up more buildings. It's not going to solve the problem, she continues.
Changing the mission permits at least a chance for stabilizing Iraq and the government in place, the democratically elected government, to survive. I think succeed, we should take the word success out of our lexicon. Stability and survival are more logical. And I think many Democrats in Congress, I'm certainly one of them, don't want us to leave Iraq. We want to change the mission in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, we have forces in 121 countries. We have a presence in virtually every country in the world. You know, nothing wrong with having an embassy, nothing wrong with having a trade, you know, council, whatever it may be. But and if the Iraqi government says, hey, you know, we would like you to have a base to protect us from invasion by, say, Iran or something like that, you know, but being an occupier is a whole nother thing. And this is what Muqtada al-Sadr is going after. You will recall it was roughly 3 years ago, 3 years and change, that George Bush, as the occupation was ongoing. Well, actually, let's just back up a little bit. On, as I recall, May 1st, which, you know, a few weeks from now, today is what, April 9th? Yeah. So today is the anniversary of the toppling of Saddam's statues. A couple of weeks will be the anniversary of George Bush standing up on the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln and declaring, underneath a banner that said mission accomplished, declaring,
my fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
So there he is saying, you know, this is the end of the war. And the fact of the matter is he was right. It was the end of the war. It was an illegal war. It was an inappropriate war. It was an uncalled for war. It was an unnecessary war. But nonetheless, that was the war. It lasted about 3 months, arguably two and change. And at that point, we had taken down the government of another country. We had seized their infrastructure. We had seized their buildings. We were taking control of their commons. We had all of the things that you would use to define the successful completion of a war. We had pacified the civilian population. I mean, we had won the war. Then began the occupation, which has continued now for 3 years and change, going on, well, now we'll be going on 4 years, because this is, you know, arguably pulling down Saddam's statue in Baghdad. That was the capturing of Baghdad. That was the end of the war. And so now began the begins the occupation. And Muqtada al-Sadr, the man whose father, or after whose father is named Sadr City, one of the largest slums or poor areas, whatever, I'm not sure what the word would be in Baghdad, but those are words that have been applied to it, in Baghdad. Al-Sadr's the arguably the second most popular cleric in the country behind Sistani. Sistani is sort of the grand old man of the Shia. Sadr is number two. He has a third, 30% anyway, of the seats in the Iraqi parliament are loyal to him overtly, explicitly. He controls a militia. And when I say militia, I mean like in the old days in the United States, in the early years of this republic, the kind of militia that Thomas Jefferson wanted to have instead of a standing army. That is, average people who during the day are bookkeepers and bakers and shopkeepers and candlestick makers and whatever they may be. And when called upon, they grab the gun out of the closet and they step out into the street and they are the militia. He controls a militia known as the Mahdi Army. It is not explicitly an army. It's a militia. That is to say, it's civilians who, you know, have day jobs, by and large, or would like to have day jobs. Many of them are unemployed right now, but if jobs were available, they would have them. He's the guy who 3 years ago in change, George Bush said, okay, we've got to take this Sadr guy out. He has too much influence. He's messing up our plans. We might not be able to capture the oil fields and hand them over to multinational corporations, whatever. He said, you know, we've got to get rid of Sadr, and so we're going to take him out. And let's send some forces into Sadr City and arrest this guy. And the next day, the U.S. forces went into Sadr City to arrest Muqtada al-Sadr, and five people were killed. One of them, Casey Sheehan, the son of Cindy Sheehan, killed by Sadr's men. Keep in mind, this is the guy who controls a third of the Iraqi government. His friend and protege, Nouri al-Maliki, is the prime minister of the country. He has been, quote, in hiding, end quote, we don't know where he is, ever since the so-called surge began. Some folks believe he's gone to Iran, at least those are the talking points in the Bush administration. Others suggest he's just, you know, hanging out in a place where U.S. forces dare not tread. But what he did this weekend is he came out and said, we need to stop speaking to Iraqis, speaking as a Shia leader, speaking as the leader of the of arguably the major party in parliament, speaking as the leader of what is probably the largest militia in the country, perhaps larger than the Iraqi army, certainly more efficient and possibly more and more effective, although, you know, not they don't have available to them the heavy armament of the United States Army. But nonetheless, there it is. Speaking as that, he said to his people that it was time for them to stop fighting each other. It was time for them to stop killing each other on the fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. And instead, direct their anger at the occupiers. As Sadr said, he's talking about Diwaniya, the city where we went in and we're trying to pacify this. He says, "All my brothers in the Mahdi army and my brothers in the security forces, stop fighting and killing because that is what our enemy and your enemy and even God's enemy hope for." He says, "God ordered you to be patient and to unite your efforts against the enemy and not against the sons of Iraq. They want to drag you into a war that ends Shiism and Islam, but they cannot." He is characterizing this as a war of religions, as a war of civilizations, as does the Bush administration. This is, as Jane Harmon points out, this is the great danger. This is an occupation which should be ended immediately. Because we are the irritant. We are the enemy that he can point to. This is the third time that Sadr has led a rebellion against U.S. forces. And each time he gets more powerful. We are simply building his power base. We are strengthening his hand. And in the process, we are paying with the blood and the cash of Americans and American people, and it's wrong. I'm going to share some thoughts of a former senator on this issue.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
My heart sing. You make everything groovy. Wild thing. A wild thing. I think I love you. But I want to know for sure. Come on and hold me tight. I love you, yes. How's that, guys? Is that about
pretty
it?
Close, Senator. A little less stuttering, please. All right. A little more of a liberal interpretation, Senator. Can you do that? And what's the pronunciation of the word heart?
Wild thing.
That's perfect, Senator. Lay it on it now.
You make my heart sing.
It's really coming along, Senator.
You make everything groovy.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. 21 minutes past the hour. Coming up on 22 minutes past the hour. Yeah, that was back in the day when Bobby Kennedy, I believe it was Von Meter, I'm not sure, but it was a pastiche on Bobby Kennedy. You know, when he was alive and seriously thinking of running for the presidency, when he was the senator from New York. And you know, obviously it wasn't Bobby Kennedy, it was somebody imitating his voice. But it was a very different time in America, you know, when we could laugh at ourselves, and yet at the same time there was really serious stuff happening. And Robert Kennedy was dealing with those issues. His son, Robert Kennedy Jr., on Huffington Post over the weekend posted some excerpts from one of his speeches, one of his father's speeches, about the Vietnam War. I have some clips from another of his speeches that I wanted to share with you because they are just so poignant. The right-wingers today are saying that the problem is that we haven't used enough military force. Just consider this in the historical context.
I think the course that we're following is an error. But I'm saying that as a United States senator, and I want to have what I say analyzed on that basis. I've always said, unless it's clear that it's their war and we're over there to help them, then we can't win. Now, they've had corruption. They've had the lack of land reform. They've failed to put in the democratic procedures that I think that we should have and the democratic processes.
So the senator from New York talking about what could and should be done. And he went on and added.
I'd like to see the South Vietnamese do more. I'd like to see them carrying this burden. I'd like to see them doing the fighting and not just Americans. Because I don't think there's any alternative to that. We're not going to win unless the South Vietnamese begin to do more and make more of an effort. And it shouldn't be just the United States and Americans doing it.
Yeah, this is essentially what Jane Harman was saying. But at the same time, the right-wingers were saying, oh, no. If you don't fight them in Vietnam, you're going to have to fight them in California, and then they're going to come across the Rockies, and eventually you're going to have to fight them in Washington, D.C.
Now we've turned when we found that the South Vietnamese haven't given the support and are not making the effort. Now we're saying we're going to fight there so that we don't have to fight in Thailand, so that we don't have to fight on the west coast of the United States so that they won't move across the Rockies.
See, I mean, this is, it's amazing how these talking points are being recycled by the right. Bobby Kennedy continued to talk about the morality of a foreign war of aggression.
I mean, do we have the right here in the United States to say that we're going to kill tens of thousands, make millions of people as we have, millions of people refugees, kill women and children as we have? There's 35,000 people without limbs in South Vietnam, 150,000 civilian casualties every year. Thousands of children are killed because of our efforts. Do we have that right here in the United States to perform these acts because we want to protect ourselves so that we don't have, it's not a greater problem for us here in the United States? I very seriously question whether we have that right. And I think other people are fighting it. Other people are carrying the burden. But this is also our war. Those of us who stay here in the United States, we must feel it. When we use napalm and when a village is destroyed and civilians are killed, this is also our responsibility. This is a moral obligation and a moral responsibility for us here in the United States. And I think we've forgotten about that. And when we switched from one point of view to another, I think that we've forgotten about it. And I think that it should be discussed, and all of us should examine our own conscience of what we are doing in South Vietnam. It's not just the fact that we're killing North Vietnamese soldiers or Viet Cong. We're also responsible for tens and tens of thousands of innocent civilian casualties. And I think we're going to have a difficult time explaining it to ourselves.
And in fact, we did. And we're still having a difficult time explaining it to ourselves, and we're going to have a very difficult time explaining Iraq to ourselves. And at the same time, right now, here we have Senator John McCain. This was yesterday, saying, quote, extremist Shiite militia leader Muqtada al-Sadr is in hiding. His followers are not contesting American forces. And then about 8 hours later, Sadr, quote, you, the Iraqi army and police forces, don't walk alongside the occupiers because they are your arch enemy. God has ordered you to be patient in front of your enemy and unite your efforts against them, not against the sons of Iraq. Time to take out the Americans, Sauter is saying. We have been here before. We have seen this movie before. We have been through this before. And Bobby Kennedy's clarion call to the morality, or essentially the immorality, of this foreign war, I think is so cogent and so poignant today. It's so important that we hear it and remember that, you know, we have been through this before. We were sold the same lies. Yeah, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Sure, we were attacked. It turned out we weren't. The clear and present danger? No. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
It's your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Air America Radio, Tom Hartman with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Last weekend, not yesterday, but a week ago yesterday, Orrin Hatch was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert. And digressing slightly here from the topic of Iraq, which I'm going to go to your calls on in just a second, but Orrin Hatch said that Carol Lam, who is the California prosecutor who put Duke Cunningham in jail and then got fired, apparently because she was about to start investigating Jerry Lewis, or maybe because her investigations of Randy Duke Cunningham could have led all the way to the White House, we may never know. Orrin Hatch said, oh, she was in charge of Clinton's campaign, and she was a law professor, and she'd never been a prosecutor. In fact, she'd been a prosecutor for 17 years. She'd never been a law professor, and she'd never been anywhere near Clinton's campaign. She was a good Republican. So this weekend, yesterday, one expects that Tim Russert would have gone out of his way to correct the record. And, in fact, here's exactly what he said on Meet the Press yesterday. And I quote, last week on this program, Senator Orrin Hatch made a mistake in describing the background of Carol Lam, a U.S. attorney in Southern California. Senator Hatch has written a letter to Meet the Press and to Carol Lam correcting the record. It's posted on our website, and our viewers should be aware of that. Before we take a break, let me turn to Nancy Pelosi. And on he goes. So, Tim Russert, our Chicken of the Week. Incredible. It's posted on our website. If you want to know what really happened, go to our website. We'll misinform you on the air. Bob in Lake Stevens, Washington. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. What I wanted to bring up was the Iraqi gas and the oil law that is trying to be passed through the Iraqi parliament that we're trying to force upon them. What it's actually going to do is codify why we're actually there, of course, the oil. Now, the thing that I think most people don't understand is that once it is passed, all the royalties will have to pay, or the corporations will have to pay to the Iraqis, is 12.5%.
Right. These are called production sharing agreements for our listeners who are not familiar with it. And it's the way typically in very, very poor and very underdeveloped countries, oil companies come in. And Bob, I'm going to drop the call here because there's a lot of road noise behind it. But thank you for the call and for pointing that out. In a country where the country itself does not have the resources to develop their own oil infrastructure, and therefore they cannot have nationalized oil without borrowing enormous amounts of money, and they may not even have the ability to borrow money because the World Bank says, no, you really need to go with the oil companies, you know. They do these production sharing agreements with the oil companies where the oil companies come in and invest their own money in developing the oil infrastructure, and then the oil belongs to the oil companies and they pay a royalty to the government. And the government ends up with a small piece of the action. And that's how it was in Iran for a while, in fact. And then there was, I'm forgetting his name. Mossadegh, I think it was, said, no, we're going to, this is our oil. Come on, you guys. And so, of course, the Shah had to overthrow him. But the fact of the matter is, in throughout the Middle East, there are virtually no countries, no areas where there are production sharing agreements. In virtually every case, Saudi Arabia, the most conspicuous and obvious one, the nation itself owns the oil company and owns the oil, just like in Venezuela, just like in Mexico, and countries all over the world, all over the world. And what we are imposing on them is something that's being also imposed on small and fragile, largely African countries, countries in the third world, where oil is being discovered, some South American countries, and it's wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. Charlie in Brooklyn. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. It was a real blast from the past to hear that Wild Thing. I had that record for a trivia question. Do you remember it was on the B-side doing the same song?
No.
It was Senator Everett Dirksen, Republican conservative, doing a mumbled reading of it.
Oh, man.
And, you know, this is...
Who was the artist?
I think it was Meter. I don't remember. I can see the 45 in my mind, but I don't remember the artist. I think you were correct. But to me, it reinforces the point, the dumbing down of the culture. You know, the lack of information to the American public that the feckless press fails to produce. Just for the past couple of weeks, PBS ran Saturday night movies, which we watched. One was Judgment at Nuremberg. This week it was the best years of our lives. The intelligent, sensitive treatment of war and veterans and the complex motivations and actions, you don't see anything like this now. And the intellectual brothel that constitutes the White House press corps and the Sunday shows, I mean, I think it really contributes to the dumbing down of people, not seeing the real motivations, the unseen hand. You know, the statue Topley, what was that, 4 years ago? Today's the anniversary.
Yeah, it took us months to see the wide-angle shot and realize that it was surrounded by tanks and staged.
Very few people there. The statue was pulled down by special forces with a crane. And, you know, we still don't hear the report last week, a Pentagon report, which knocks out the second one of their motivations for the war, showing it to be false. Did you hear that mentioned on any of the Sunday talk shows? I didn't. You see that what's going on, a rally of 100,000 people today in Najaf protesting the American presence, what you brought up, Mukta's order to kill Americans. So many things are not widely known. Bremer, who was Bush's Andover roommate, the incompetence, the debathification, the Heritage Foundation trainees who were put in and incompetently mismanaging the Iraqi economy that led to the strife we see today, the 14 enduring bases, the huge number of contractors, their actions, the costs and casualties.
The huge embassy in the Green Zone, all of it's Charlie spot on. I absolutely, you know, well said, and thank you very much. And let me tell you where I think this all originated. I think it all originated in 1981 with Ronald Reagan, when Ronald Reagan stopped, for all practical purposes, enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and said corporations can buy out corporations, they can control entire market sectors, they can get as big as they want, and if a defense contractor wants to buy a company that controls so much of the media that the vast majority of America is exposed every day to what they have to say, that's just fine with us, thank you very much. And that has brought us this profound dumbing down. And the last president to enforce the Sherman Act and break up a big corporation was Jimmy Carter, breaking up AT&T. And it's time for us to start enforcing that law again. Instead, Reagan stopped it, and it led to that era, that decade of mergers and acquisitions throughout the 80s, where the big got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and in the process shed hundreds of thousands of jobs and you know, giving the axe to people in the name of efficiency, and the net result, the dumbing down of our culture overall. Sheila in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Sheila.
Hi. It's great to talk to you. I had a question I wanted to ask you. The right wing has been making noises about how there really were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They had cited some new documents or something. I've heard John Loftus say this. But the other night I was listening to a syndicated, nationally well-known talk show in which a British citizen was a guest. His name is Michael Shrimpton. Have you heard of him?
Yes.
Okay, and apparently he is a he probably is a member of the Conservative Party in Britain, but he said there absolutely is true that Bush did the right thing. These documents prove it, and that he thinks right now the right thing is also to go to war in Syria and Iran both, and have large numbers of troops to get rid of terrorism once and for all. What do you think of his opinion? Is he right about these documents
and
everything?
Well, first of all, if a country having weapons of mass destruction is a justification for invading that country, we should have invaded the Soviet Union in 1950.
Right.
I mean, we should be invading Italy right now. We should be invading France. France has the world's third largest nuclear arsenal, as I recall. I mean, if that's your criteria, then, you know, all bets are off, number one. And really the criteria is, does this country present an imminent threat to the United States? And Saddam Hussein not only was not representing any kind of a threat to us, he was throwing his arms out and saying, come on in, inspectors, come on in, you're welcome, look around, anything you want, I got nothing. He was blowing up his own rockets in the 2 weeks before we started bombing him. I mean, he was taking his own rockets out and blowing them up because they had a range that was 100 kilometers, 70 miles longer than the range that was allowed by the United Nations. And he hadn't realized that before that point. And, or at least he said he hadn't. I mean, he was probably trying to shave the facts. But nonetheless, I mean, there was no threat. And Syria and Iran, if we go into these countries, it's just going to be Iraq all over again, only worse, you know, writ large, writ huge. And it's going to be an absolute disaster, Sheila. These guys are, what they're really trying to do is bring about the end of the world. They're trying to bring about the return of Jesus in the millennium, in my opinion. Many of them, actually. Ray in Ardsley, New York. Hey, Ray, about 45 seconds here before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I spoke to you about 2 months ago. Quickly mentioned crimes of international terrorism committed by the Eisenhower administration. But anyway, I'd just like to mention, I don't have much time. You know, the United States invaded South Vietnam. I mean, it started Kennedy ordered the bombing of South Vietnamese villages. It was a full uprising in South Vietnam against
it. Actually started during the Eisenhower administration.
Right. Well,
he
prevented the national election from taking place. Right. But yeah. Kennedy actually started a massive saturation bombing of South Vietnamese villages against a brutal dictator who was not supported by the population. And
right. Ray, what's your point?
Well, my point is, the United States, the greatest sin in the eyes of the rulers of this country is for a leader of another nation to believe that the natural resources of his country should benefit the people of his country first.
Yeah, yeah,
you're
spot on. I don't disagree with you at all, and it's one of the reasons why our Mr. Hugo Chavez should be very concerned. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. It's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, you know, we'd settle for a clean election, because if we had a clean election without a lot of money in it and just, you know, people talking about the issues, then we'd have a national health care system and we'd have a strong Social Security program and a whole lot of social ills might be solved and good may come out of it and peace may come to prevail in the world. And oh, my. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner on the line with us in the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, even Hillary Clinton's going to be doing some low-budget fundraisers, she announced.
Oh, really? That's great. Oh, by the way, I want to mention, and if you don't mind, let me just toss this in here, if I may. Air America Radio is working with MoveOn.org to broadcast the first of three virtual town hall meetings. I've been ranting about the topic of Iraq here for the last 45 minutes, Ellen, and this is apropos to that. MoveOn's executive director, Eli Parser, is moderating, and Air America has recorded questions from MoveOn members with answers from the seven leading Democratic presidential candidates. That's Dodd, Kucinich, Richardson, Biden, Obama, Clinton, and Edwards on the subject of Iraq. And both Air America and MoveOn are going to be streaming this virtual town hall meeting commercial free on their websites tomorrow night, Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time. And then Air America is also going to run it three times on the network as a two-hour special with commercials, Wednesday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time, replacing Politically Direct and EcoTalk. Saturday at 10 from 10 a.m. to noon, replacing 2 hours of The Best of Sam Cedar. And Sunday from 8 to 10, replacing 2 hours of The Best of the Young Turks. And that may vary depending on the station that you're listening to, the affiliates that you're listening to. But it's all very, very easily available and commercial-free tomorrow night on the websites of both Air America at airamerica.com and MoveOn at MoveOn.org. Now, what's going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen?
Okay, well, it's interesting. The issue is now coming front and center about the supplemental. The president is going to be making a speech tomorrow at a VFW on the supplemental. Republicans apparently are thinking about sending, or they have sent, a letter to Nancy Pelosi that essentially says, come back from vacation, you know, this supplemental bill has been pending since February, et cetera. Excuse me, I think they have such short memories. Weren't these the guys that we had to do a huge omnibus after the election because they couldn't get many of the spending bills, like most of them, done before they left for the elections?
Like virtually all of them, yeah. Yeah, no, the Republicans, I mean, this is a classic case of the pot calling the kettle black or whatever, you know, awful old cliche you want to use. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, they'll probably get away with it.
Well, they probably will get away with it, and, you know, they certainly have the echo chamber to continue it. Some other things going on this week. The House is out of session. The Senate is in session. The big hearing to watch this week is that Russ Feingold is going to chair a judiciary subcommittee on the issue of those FBI letters, the security letters that they send to people and the FBI overreach on that. And I believe that's happening on Thursday, so that is definitely going to be something to, as I say, get out your popcorn on.
These are cases where apparently the FBI actually broke the law and did so at the behest of Attorney General Gonzalez.
Well, or whoever may have signed them, may have even been before Gonzalez. It's been apparently going on for a period of time, and I'm not even actually sure that it had to be signed by Gonzalez. I don't know what the chain of command is. It could be the head of the FBI. But they would have needed to get permission from the court to do these letters, and of course they just didn't.
Right, right. So you wonder how high this goes in the Bush administration, you know, to Cheney's office, to Bush's office?
One doesn't ever know about any of this, does anybody?
Indeed.
A couple other interesting things. Today, of course, there was this big march in two cities in Iraq. Very peaceful, very, very large. Gordon Jonro, who was giving the gaggle today while the president was on the road at the border in Arizona, said that al-Sadr was absolutely operating outside of the rule of law in Iraq. However, he said, well, under the old administration, Hussein, there couldn't have even been this peaceful protest. So this shows that there's essentially progress in Iraq. That's pretty much what Gordon said today.
The fact that they're trampling American flags and burning them and screaming death to Americans, that's a sign of progress.
Hey, listen.
I suppose you can argue that the fact that the Iraqis feel free to criticize their government is a good thing. The problem is that 40, 50, 60 bodies a day are showing up handcuffed with drill holes in their heads and shot in the head all around Baghdad every single day of people who have protested their government or are at odds with their government. So, there's a certain dissonance here.
Stay tuned, because as you know, the president's going to be giving his speech, as I said, at the VFW tomorrow. But McCain is going to be giving his Iraq winnable speech on Wednesday.
Jeez. But is he going to have?
We're going to hear from both of these guys this week.
Is he going to have John, or is he going to have Joe Lieberman standing next to him? I mean, it's just, I was just astounded by Lieberman's performance over the last few days. He's been so out there, you know, he's been very, very visible speaking out on these issues. I guess the meme, in fact, for the week is, if we leave, chaos will ensue. As if there's not chaos there now.
Those exact words must be on the talking points, because from the Republican host or conservative host that I report for, they pretty much have all said the same thing. So then you know the RNC has sent out those words.
Yeah.
Word of the day.
Yeah. We get the Republican, I think they call it their research letter. It's amazing how that thing arrives, in the morning, and throughout the day you hear those talking points on right-wing talk radio, and by evening, about half the time, they've made their way all the way to, where, like David Gregory yesterday, NBC, was saying, yeah, Nancy Pelosi was sloppy in Syria. It's a right-wing talking point. There's no reality to it, but it's made its way all the way up to NBC News. It's incredible.
Excellent echo chamber they've got.
They do. They really do. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Ellen, thank you for being with
us.
Thank you. Great talking with you. Michael Waldman, the counsel for the Brennan Center of Justice, talking about voting rights and election fraud. Up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Broadcasting live from our flagship station, KPOJ, on the banks of the Willamette River here in Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman with you. What is about as common as dying by lightning strike? Justin Levitt is with us. He's a counsel for the Brennan Center of Justice, working on voter rights and elections. BrennanCenter.org, the website. Justin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You and Michael Waldman wrote an article called The Myth of Voter Fraud, and in it you suggest that voter fraud, which is the phrase that Republicans are just loving to use these days, statistically happens about as often as death by lightning strike.
Yeah.
True?
That's exactly right. It's the sort of fraud we're talking about here, individuals sneaking into the polls to misrepresent themselves as someone else or to misrepresent themselves as eligible, happens incredibly, incredibly rarely. The number of zeros before the decimal, after the decimal, when you get down to the percentage, it's the sort of thing that happens, as you say, less often than lightning striking.
There was a challenge in Washington State in 2004 in the gubernatorial election, Christine Gregoire's election, where they actually found one case of voter fraud.
They found in 2006 they found one case that might, and that's the important thing, might have been a double vote. What they find in these sorts of cases all the time are little irregularities. Little glitches in the system, votes get counted that probably shouldn't be, but it's not malicious individuals sneaking into the polls to cast votes when they shouldn't be.
So how do these little things happen? What you're characterizing as little things, which Republicans would say is a national crisis that we need to pass huge federal laws over and we need to be firing U.S. attorneys over, which is really what this all gets back to. What are these? Give me some examples of this.
Yeah, some examples. You go into the polls and there are a whole bunch of lines on the poll book where you're supposed to sign, and instead of signing next to your name, you sign one line down. That person happens to have died last year. And when they look at the poll books, they find out, these things add up over time. They lead to huge headlines about dead voters marching on the polls and rising from the grave in order to cast a vote, when really what it amounts to is you're missing the line by your name by a couple centimeters or so.
Really? That's how the dead vote stuff happens?
That's how lots of it happens. Another way in which it seems to happen is by shoddy matching of lists from one place to another. You compare the list of voters to the list of people who've died, and sure enough, John Smith, born on January 1st, 1950, appears on both lists. That doesn't mean that the same person voted and also died. That means there are two John Smiths who happen to be born on the same day.
Hmm. Although I would think that that's probably a pretty rare thing.
It's pretty rare, but so is the amount of time that these sorts of misconduct allegations crop up. It's
right.
the thing.
Yeah, I mean,
who's
going to take a chance of committing two felonies in order to cast a vote?
Well, that's exactly right.
It makes no sense. So we have the Republican, and frankly, the Democratic Party is not talking about the real problem in my mind, which is election fraud, is what happened in Florida in 2000, is what happened in Ohio in 2004. Caging, I mean, the Republican Party's been operating under a restraining order for over 20 years now against caging, which they did in Ohio again in 2004. The crime of voting while black in Florida in 2000 and 2002 and 2004 and 2006. Why is it that the Republicans claim that individuals, particularly people of non-WASP ethnicity, that individuals are engaged in some huge, massive, nationwide voter fraud conspiracy? Why is it that that Republican claim is getting a lot of traction and the Democratic concern and the NAACP's concern of election fraud as opposed to voter fraud, institutional fraud that's happening now two people have gone to prison in Ohio. I doubt most Americans even know this because of fraud in the 2004 election where Kerry, you know, supposedly lost to Ohio, that's getting no traction.
It's true, and it's a big problem. Why is it? It seems that they've managed to build up a network of stories that sound compelling, and people just buy into them. The sorts of things you're talking about, yes, it's true. They keep pointing to instances of individuals sneaking off one vote at a time at the polls as this nationwide epidemic. Some of it is sincere. Some of it they actually believe this to happen all the time. We can tell you from the studies we've done it doesn't. And some of it we think is very calculated. If you can foster enough worry and enough fear that there's an epidemic of individual voter fraud going on, then you can pass some of the restrictive laws on photo identification, on proof of citizenship we've seen, that actually just lock out legitimate citizens.
Right. And this actually, in the Supreme Court case of Purcell versus Gonzalez, one of the justices suggested that if these laws that clamped down on or tightened up voting restriction, eligibility in such a way that people, you know, really felt it, if these things were going to go into place, that they may actually have the effect of disenfranchising voters.
That's right. It's gotten to the absurd point when, as the Supreme Court said, when people who feel disenfranchised by the thought that these sorts of things might happen, the people who buy into the epidemic, that their rights are then cast right up against and held at almost equal weight to real people getting shut out of the polls for real on Election Day.
Right. In the 2000 election and in the 2004 election, the two presidential elections, there were reports coming out of a number of states of serious election fraud going on. People in African American communities being called and in some cases receiving flyers in the mail or stuck in their doors telling them that if any member of their family had any crime, including a parking ticket, that when they show up to vote, they would be arrested.
Not only would they be arrested, they'd take their children away.
Wow. Wow. And then, you know, out here in Oregon, I know that it was actually videotaped in Las Vegas, in Nevada. The Las Vegas television station had the videotape. I saw the thing on the web back in the 2004 election. We had, and this was in a variety of states, there was a company that was, you know, apparently one of these, inflatable, collapsible companies that the RNC apparently hired to set up card tables out in front of federal buildings, libraries, shopping centers, whatnot, and says, you know, vote, register to vote here, and people would register to vote, and if they checked the box that they were registering as a Republican, that was fine, that registration would get passed through. If they checked the box saying that they wanted to register to vote in the Democratic primaries, then their ballot, then their registration got shredded, torn up, thrown away, burned, whatever, and those people show up to vote, they're given a placebo ballot, a provisional ballot, because they can't find their name. And then when they can't, and then, you know, and they leave thinking that they voted. And then when it comes time to actually count the provisional ballots, they say, hey, this person never registered, and their vote gets thrown away.
That's right. It was a company called Spruill and Associates. And the allegations there, thankfully, it's only one company. But the epidemic of these sorts of things, of the legal restrictions and misconduct that actually shuts real people out happens nationwide. It's part of the reason why you see that, you know, less than half of eligible Americans vote whenever they get the opportunities, because it's for a lot of people just very hard.
So Justin Levitt, this brings us to, with the Brennan Center, BrennanCenter.org, this brings us to the core of this issue, which is we know that eight attorneys were fired, and one of the allegations, one of the reasons, one of the justifications given by the administration is that they were fired, these U.S. attorneys, these federal prosecutors, because they were failing to prosecute voter fraud. But in fact, isn't the bigger concern the other 80-some, 86 or whatever, 87-some U.S. attorneys who were doing the good Republican thing and were, talk about that.
Yeah, it's certainly an issue. I mean, it does make you wonder if the search is out for individuals who are allegedly committing voter fraud, if this is being used to buttress some of the calls for strong restrictions on ID requirements and other things like that. It does make you wonder if these are the eight that wouldn't play ball, what happened elsewhere around the country. Now, there's no indication that places that individual attorneys have been incredibly overzealous all over the place. That said, in Missouri, for example, there was a new U.S. attorney installed not long before the election. Sure enough, 4 days before the election, 5 days before the election in 2006, suddenly came up with indictments that haven't yet panned out.
Interesting. And none of these attorneys, I'm assuming, are doing things like trying to track down Sproul and Associates.
We certainly haven't heard any reports of that yet. Beyond the U.S. attorney question, the overall focus on individuals who aren't committing voter fraud, on this thing that just doesn't happen, rather than reforming the election system to take care of voters, to process voters through smoothly, that's just a misguided focus overall. It's the prosecutions and the system in general.
Well, it's actually very slick partisanship. I mean, yes, the Republican Party, you know, pushing the probability that people who vote for them will show up and people who won't. In my opinion. Anyhow, Justin Levitt, he wrote the piece, The Myth of Voter Fraud. You can find it over at BrennanCenter.org. Justin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. 21 minutes past the hour. I want to get into this whole issue of big lies and little lies, as Paul Krugman calls them, these sweet little lies, that was so well highlighted by my conversation with Justin Levitt just a moment ago. First, though, Bill in Los Angeles has been sitting patiently on the line here for a while. Bill, the chat room tells me that the voice in that that Bobby Kennedy pastiche was actually James Voight, the brother of actor John Voight, and that this was came out in 1967, and it was by the Hardly Worth It Players.
That's right. That was my group. My name is Bill Minkin, and Dennis Holy and Steve Barron were the other members. I don't know what other name you have there.
Okay, I'm telling you, it's from the chat room, so may not be right. But you were number 20 on the hit parade in the United States, and recorded under the name of Senator Bobby. Is that right?
That's right. I was very complimented by that other caller because they said they thought it was Senator Dirksen on the other side. That was me as well.
That's great. That's great. Well, how much times have changed, eh, Bill?
Oh yeah. Well, actually, the reason we made that single was Dirksen had a single out that sold 250,000 copies in 2 weeks called "Gallant Men" in that year, and it, with his voice. Remember it? He read this.
Oh yeah.
This
poem, and he had this deep gravelly voice. Yeah.
And we had an album out called "The Hardly Worth It Report." It was like a news thing on the Huntley and Brinkley. and Chet Hartley and David Worthit. And we got banned because we had a bit of the Beatles and the Pope arriving at the same time in the wrong terminals. and Murray the K interviewing the Pope, et cetera. And all the kids screaming, Paul, Paul. Of course, it's the wrong Paul. But anyway, we were banned. And so this was an effort to get us some airtime. And we first recorded the Dirksen thing. And then Dennis Holy said, well, let's try Kennedy because we did a Senator Prince Charming in a housing investigation on the album. So we did that, and within 24 hours, it was on the air. It was a very exciting time. It was crazy.
Yeah, and it was also a time when America was, you know, having honest discussions out in the open, and Walter Cronkite was actually reporting the news, not the Republican spin, you try to communicate, you know, you try to tell somebody who's in their 20s about how different America has become over the last 30 years, and it's just. It's breathtaking, the difference. So,
well, we
anyhow,
both Senator Kennedy, too, by the way. And originally we were frightened about even releasing this because at the time, also to give your listeners some perspective, at the time he was still brooding about the assassination of John Kennedy.
Sure.
And so people assumed he had no sense of humor or was still very, you know, very serious. And he loved it. We came into the office and they took pictures and he said, you sound probably better than I, more than me than I do. How'd you like to switch jobs? And I said, I don't think I'm ready, Senator.
That's great.
So,
well, Bill, thanks a lot for the heads up and for the info and for
and
the flashback.
And thanks again for playing. It was great hearing it again.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Good to hear from you. 24 minutes past the hour. Okay, here's Paul Krugman. Has an op-ed, yesterday's op-ed, the New York Times. And this is so brilliant. I mean, he gets right to the point. He says there is the big lie, the power of the big lie, which Goebbels, I believe it was, wrote about. It's typically attributed to Hitler. I don't think it's from Mein Kampf. I think it was Goebbels, but I may be wrong. In any case, there's the big lie. The idea that if people trust a leader, even if their trust is a little frayed around the edges, if people trust a leader and the leader says something absolutely outrageous, that they will assume that there must be something that they don't know that would cause this person to say this, because nobody would say that if it wasn't true. So that's the big lie. And the big lie, of course, is that we had to attack Iraq. And the big lie has been working for the Bush administration for the last 4 years to some extent. It worked very, very effectively for the first year and a half. We had to attack Iraq. It had something to do with 9/11. We had to attack Iraq. It was a clear and present danger to America. They had weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. Turns out it was all lies. And not only was it all lies, they knew it was lies at the time they said it, which is why they took down or tried to take down people like Joe Wilson, who pointed it out early on. But then Paul Krugman talks about the little lie. The little lie, the kind of background hum, Bill Clinton getting his hair cut on Air Force One. No, it didn't stop the traffic. Nancy Pelosi wanting a big fancy jet. No, that wasn't the case. All the phony scandals in the Clinton years, Whitewater, Trooper Gate, Travel Gate, File Gate, Christmas Card Gate, they were all false claims. Even the false claim that all the W's were missing from the keyboards. Karl Rove made it up, or somebody in the White House made it up. It never happened. And yet every time one of these small lies gets out there, it takes one more little chunk out of the hide of the Democrats. One more little small piece. And this is what they're doing right now against Nancy Pelosi. And with all these lies, literally lies, about her trip to Syria and the hysteria around it. And Krugman points out that one of the main instruments of getting these small lies out there is the Fox News Channel. And he says this is why Democratic politicians are saying that they're not even going to participate in Fox-hosted debates. And I just tip my hat to Paul Krugman. So spot on. Back with your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
One man come in the name of love. One
34 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman program. Does not lead to stiff thinking, however. As Congress investigates the politicization of the United States Attorney's offices by the Bush administration, it should review the extraordinary events the other day in a federal courtroom in Washington. This from today's New York Times editorial, another layer of scandal. Here's the bottom line. One of the federal prosecutors who was not fired as they were ginning up to the election, the 2006 election, one of these prosecutors pushed forward a prosecution of a woman by the name of Georgia Thompson, a state employee. She was sent to prison on such a flimsy charge that when it ultimately came before an actual court and judge, in just 20 minutes of testimony, they threw the thing out and said, there's no case here. But it was just before the election. And so she got sent to prison. And because she worked for a Democrat in the Department of Administration in that state, she was working for Jim Doyle, the governor Jim Doyle. The Democrats turned this into campaign advertisements. Democratic corruption. Actually, they would have called it Democrat corruption, right? As the New York Times notes, the Chicago-based United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit seemed shocked by the injustice of her conviction and took the extraordinary step of releasing Ms. Thompson from prison immediately after hearing arguments without waiting to issue a ruling. One of the judges hinted that Ms. Thompson may have been railroaded. It strikes me, said Judge Diane Wood, that your evidence is beyond thin, this talking to the prosecutor, which raises the question. Okay, we've been wondering what happened to these prosecutors who got fired. What about the ones who stayed in office? Have they been carrying water for the Bushies and the Republican Party? Well, apparently. The Times says Congress should look into both cases. There's another case similar to this as well out of Chicago. They say the Congress should look into both cases to determine whether partisan politics played a role and whether they were coordinated with anyone at the Justice Department or the White House. Yeah, good plan. Meanwhile, just this small story. The CEO of Ford Motor Company, Alan Mulally, says to reporters, as George Bush is about to stick an electrical outlet into the hydrogen tank of a new car, he says, I just thought, oh, my goodness. So I started walking faster, and the president walked faster, and he got to the curb before I did. I violated all the protocols. I touched the president. I grabbed his arm, and I moved him up to the front. I wanted the president to be sure that he plugged it into the electricity, not into the hydrogen. This is all off the record, right? Right. 1-866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I'm grateful to speak with you. I wanted to touch on two things. First had to do with lies. You know, one of the things that we always taught our children was the importance of not lying. And it's become so prevalent because one loses their ability to discern truth. And I was speaking with one of my sons on the weekend, and I brought up about women standing and how we do that, you know, for the intention of peace. And he said, well, that's fine as long as you don't hug Cindy Sheehan. I said, really? And he went on, and I said, you know, you need to really be aware of that Fox propaganda that you're hearing. And I said to me, when you were in Desert Storm and I lost you, that you would think that that was wrong, that I wanted to know why you died. So we kind of opened up a door there. But my second part, Tom, had to do with the soldiers. It's been like a dangling participle for me, defending and sending and sending our troops. And I came to the reality that maybe they want all of our troops gone, Tom, because how it read in the Times here in Seattle that we're going to have 20 brigades. This is when Bush talked about the surge, you know, the surge. We're going to have 20 brigades left here when that first number was called out. That's frightening, Tom.
Because why?
It's frightening because I don't believe anymore in what these individuals are doing. There's a sinister there's a sinister cast over everything. You know, there's a good possibility that that would be a great way to alleviate all of our protectors here in the country. Look at 9/11. Look at how many. Look at how many we lost. I mean, that was really our first soldiers, the people in the towers, the first aid responders, all those. Those were.
Well,
our,
you could if you wanted to cast that in the context of a war, or you could say that like the people in the federal building in Oklahoma City, they were the victims of a heinous crime that was committed by a small handful of people who should have been tracked down and prosecuted and put in prison, and that would have been the end of it. This was not a foreign state that attacked us. This was not Pearl Harbor. This was a crime.
Absolutely.
Britain is dealing with the subway bombing as a crime. They're bringing these people to justice. They're putting them in courts. They're prosecuting them. They're sending them to jail. They dealt with the IRA
people.
As criminals. Exactly.
You call them Christianists. You know, I call it tomatoes. You call it potatoes.
Yeah.
The Christianists, the Dominionists, they are a sinister group. Because the people
who want to dominate a nation by virtue of religion. I'm not going to disagree with you on that. Mark in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was here listening to you talk about this voting issue, and made me think of a question. Why should the people of this country give up one right to be able to exercise another one? The right to privacy in order to exercise what I think we have is the right to vote.
Yeah, actually, the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore ruled that you do not have a constitutional right to vote for President of the United States. You do have the right to vote for lower elected offices, but... setting that little nuance aside, I assume by you're talking about giving up the right to privacy, you're talking about what? The things like the Real ID Act?
Well, yeah, the voting to identify yourself, okay, in order to vote, whether it's for the dog catcher or the president who's a
I don't disagree, Mark, and this is the bizarre world that we're in, this rabbit hole that we've fallen through where these cons are trying to convince us that the big problem is that somebody who's not a citizen might decide that they want to vote. When with the right hand they're waving that one around, when in the last 2 years they've found one such person, maybe. And with the left hand, they're disenfranchising 90,000 people in Florida, 100,000 people in Ohio, just ripping them off the voter rolls. They're sending letters and phone calls. They're calling people up and saying, if you're voting Republican, you vote on Tuesday. If you're voting Democratic, you're voting on Wednesday. They're moving precincts around. They're making, they're caging. They're rigging voting machines. I mean, this is off the wall. Martin in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, where I'm broadcasting from.
Yeah,
hey, Martin,
doing,
what's
Tom?
Up? Great.
Listen to this election stuff. I can't help but get cynical and discouraged because you know as well as I do that the reason the big lie gets reported and the little lies don't is because the media has also changed hands the past 30 years and is owned differently than it used to, and news is treated differently.
That was my whole point about the no longer enforcing the Sherman Act. Absolutely.
You know,
and it's not just broadcast media. It's right across the board.
Radio, print, newspapers and magazines, as well as television.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing that gets me is I look at election reform, especially the campaign finance reforms. We've been through this great last week of the numbers game of, you know, who won the most money. If we move the primary dates up, that's just going to that's like having the primaries being held in February. You know, you'll have two people out of each party that'll be the leaders, and then we're going to have to endure, 9 months of negative
I know.
Ads?
I know. There has to be a better solution. I mean, the tragedy is that, it's not obvious what it is. I mean, what they're doing in I believe it's Maine and Arizona seems like a good start, you know, with voter-owned elections. And it's a good road to go down. We do that here in Portland. We have voter-owned elections. If you can get 1,000 people to give you a $5 contribution and, you know, sign a petition, put their name on a petition, then you qualify for, I think it's $100,000 in city funding. And if somebody competes with you and say they spend $125,000, the city gives you another $25,000. In other words, you're never going to be outcompeted once you're in that program. And it works very well here. And the only thing I can think of is something like that at a federal level. But it's a tough one. It's a real tough one to make that happen. Gail, speaking of Maine, Gail in Maine. Hey, Gail, have about just about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Oh, well,
in the state of Maine,
listening
on 870.
And I grabbed my book, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, too.
Yes,
unless we
Mark
stop
Crispin
them.
Miller.
Mark Crispin Miller. Yeah, I opened up and I have this newspaper clipping from the local newspaper about former GOP officials sentenced in phone jamming. This is just an example of the kind of things the right-wingers do. The Republicans, they're the ones that committed like 99% of the voter fraud. Where do they get off blaming it on the Democrats?
Well, this is the distinction. They're committing election fraud, which is institutional, and they're accusing individuals of committing voter fraud. And that's the thing. We need to define these terms. Voter fraud is where, you know, I go and say I'm actually a citizen of a different state and I try to vote there. Election fraud is where a party goes and they prevent 30,000 people from voting. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Okay.
I can't serve you anymore.
Not that you ever were.
I've done all the damage I can do.
Yeah, we noticed.
There's only one more thing I can do for you.
And what might that be?
I'll be your sacrificial lamb.
Okay.
Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham.
Yuck.
And while you're at it, chain me too. For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
Oh, please impeach me. That sounds like Jim Turr from BlueCanyonSatire.com. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And AirAmerica.com for the show blog and information. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, listening on KKZN. What's up?
Having said in a lot of levels of government committee meetings and legislative things, I have seen that there's been a lot of discussion of this voter fraud thing, but election fraud gets almost no traction. Actually, with voter fraud and the ID stuff, Colorado even had a rule. I think they're changing now, but even a passport couldn't get you a driver's license.
Yeah, this is all part of the right-wing attempt to try to drive down voting by minorities.
Yeah,
and it works in the areas where they're doing it, where they're successful.
And as Paul Krugman said, we've got to worry about the attorneys that are still in office. And it's been interesting to note that pretty good information regarding election fraud has been turned over to the FBI here, but nothing seems to happen. There's no investigation as far as our inside sources have shown.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is information that may have shown that national elections was reversed.
Right, particularly in Ohio. I mean, we have two people now who have gone to prison in Ohio for rigging the recount. What is it of the main election that they were trying to hide? And yet the federal prosecutor in Ohio, we're looking into other matters. This isn't really of high importance. Jeff, good point, and thank you for making it. Well said. Doug in Staten Island, New York. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? Listen, you know, I was just thinking, with all these schemes and the rest of it, I think the only way for us to try and get back into the bowl game here is to try and get the fairness doctrine put back in. And I was wondering, I mean, we have an unusual, I'm here in New York, in Staten Island. For instance, we have a channel here called New York One. It's a pretty popular channel. Most people have cable and most people watch it.
Yeah, I've watched it many times, yeah.
Well, here we had, you know, we have Ms. Clinton with an extra $10 million because she had basically a non-campaigning campaign. She had a guy named Jonathan Tessini who polled 12%, but New York One wouldn't put him on in a debate with her because they said he didn't have enough money. They wanted him to have $500,000, I believe, $500,000,
right,
which is...
I remember. We reported that on this program when it happened.
And here's the thing, Tom. New York One is owned by the parent company, Time Warner. They give Ms. Clinton $100,000. New York One won't put Tessini on this. And you have Ms. Clinton going around getting these things.
Here's my concern. Doug, I'm halfway agreeing with you and halfway disagreeing
it's
with
DLC
you. Here's how.
What I'm worried about, John, Tom. The DLC.
Yeah, the DLC is not high on my list of friendly forces either. But here's my concern about the fairness doctrine. I think that it's not just reasonable, but a healthy thing for us to have some sort of programming in the public interest legislation where if newspapers want to continue to get the subsidy that they've had literally since the founding of this country, that they can be distributed by fourth class mail, which operates at a loss for the Postal Service. It's a subsidy for newspapers. If radio and television stations want to continue using the airwaves, that they do have to do some programming that is in the public interest. On the other hand, when I was in radio back in the 60s and 70s during the Fairness Doctrine time, and one of the stations that I worked at where I did news for nearly 7 years, we had a talk show on in the afternoon. And because of the Fairness Doctrine, if we had politician A on, we had to have on politicians B,
right,
C, and, you know, and it was a mess. And because of that, we avoided politics, and instead we had on the guy telling you how to make sure that your roses didn't get aphids. And I'm frankly very concerned about that. And so I'm seeing both sides of this. I don't want, and at the risk of sounding like some kind of libertarian or right-wing nutcase, I don't want the government telling me or defining for me what is left and what is right and when we've had enough of either one on our airwaves. I think that is a disaster waiting to happen. On the other hand, let me just finish the sentence. At the same time, I think it's important that people who hold a public trust, which is the Fourth Estate, have some responsibility to the public, and there be some mechanism to make sure that they fulfill that responsibility.
Here's my point. If you have local candidates who poll out fairly well in these polls, all right, instead of having them come to basically the corporate types and have to get the money so they can go back on their airwaves to spend it to get their message, because all we get is, you know, who's raised this, who's raised that, who's ahead, who's behind. We don't get anything of the policies. We just put money aside. It would be a pittance, and declare ourselves 527s. All right, 527s.
You know, if everybody, here's the thing, Doug, if everybody in the United States, if all the working people in the United States, which is 115 million of us, if we all put in $10 a year, that's $1.15 billion, if my math is right.
There you go.
Right? And that's $1 billion a year. If we do that over a four-year period, that's $4 billion. That's more than has ever been spent on an election. I mean, we're fixing for this to be the first $1 billion election.
Yeah.
That's $10 from each working person in the United States, I believe, if I'm doing my math right off the top of my head. And in England, what they do in the United Kingdom, they say you can't spend more than $100,000 on an election campaign, period. And for that reason, they have very short campaigns. Now, the problem with saying that in the United States is the First Amendment. That's restricting free speech. But I think that we really seriously need to consider publicly funded elections, and it's not that expensive. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Norman Reynolds, who says we're being too hard on Bush in regards to Iraq. Yeah, right. And Peter Eisner's here on his new book, The Italian Letter, How the Administration Used a Fake Letter to Build the Case for a War in Iraq. And as always, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.